Yes, so as Subhadramati is saying, we take the journey a little bit further tonight. Last night, Mahamani beautifully evoked the Buddha. And I want to pick up the story at one point where Mahamani brought out the connection between the Buddha and the second jewel, the Dharma. She talked about this episode, this fascinating, mysterious episode, in just after the Buddha's enlightenment. So this is where I want to pick up the story, and we'll see where it leads from there. So it seems to be what happens is, after the Buddha rose from under the tree, under the Bodhi tree, as part of his enlightenment experience, for want of a better word, was unfolding, he found himself looking for something to revere. Yeah, he looked around for something to revere. It seemed like this reverence was part of the nature of the awakening mind, or the awakened mind, maybe even by this point. And not finding any man or God or being worthy to look up to, he found himself looking up to the Dharma itself. He found himself revering and relying upon the Dharma himself. Very, very important, very strange episode will, I hope and I imagine, keep me reflecting for one for the rest of my Buddhist life, I'm sure. Very, very mysterious episode in the Buddha's life. What is it that he is revering? What is it he is relying upon? And what is the connection between the two? So this is what I want to look at in this talk. What is the Dharma? What could be this thing that the Buddha reveres? So after this episode, the Buddha gets up and he goes out to try and find his old companions. You may recall that the Buddha had been practicing austerities with some friends, and they'd rejected him because it seemed like he'd given up. He was existing, as I think Mahamani say, on one grain of rice, and had been revered as a great ascetic practitioner, a great seeker in this way, practicing these austerities, this kind of yoga. And they'd shunned him. They'd said that when he'd given up with this style of practice, they'd shunned him, and he'd gone off alone. So after the experience, he wants to communicate. He wants to... He gets up and goes to find his old friends. He walks 50 miles. I've been to the place in India where he walks. He walks a full 50 miles. Seems straight. He goes to find his old companions, the five old his comrades in the spiritual life, and he finds them. And atmosphere. I'd really like to try and wonder what the atmosphere would have been like. You know, they've kind of had this party in the way. The Buddha appears. He would have been completely emaciated, but when he went to sit under the Bodhi tree, he'd grown so thin he could put his hand through his stomach and feel his spine. He was nearly dead. He'd nearly killed himself with his struggle to find the truth. And then he's been sitting under this tree for a long time. So I imagine him as being, he's slightly building up strength by this point. You know, he'd been fed some rice milk by a local village woman. And I imagine him as hairy, unkempt, emaciated after all this time. He's just walked 50 miles and he's a Buddha. So he's enlightened and he approaches his old friends. And it seems like The sheer presence of the Buddha stuns them, and he sits down with them, and they accept him back, and they want to listen to what he says. And this is when the Dharma, this is when another aspect of the Dharma comes fully into the world: the Dharma as teaching, the Dharma as communication. I was just meditating earlier down here in front of this awesome shrine, I was just thinking about this episode in my imagination, trying to picture what it might be like. And I was just thinking, God, I would have loved to have been there. Oh, I just, you know, it's sort of the Dharma comes to us these days with sort of quite neatly packaged. You know, we get these books with these lists sort of explaining, well, the Buddha taught this and then he taught that. This is what you should do. This is how it help. This is how it can help. You know, off you go. Whereas, of course, it didn't start like that. Of course, it would have been this, you know, the attempt, this man, this Buddha, trying to communicate reality. He didn't even know if it was fully possible. And who knows what he would have said in that communication to try and get his experience across. Anyway, so he did seem to succeed, and there's this famous exclamation after he starts to try and communicate what he's understood. One of his old friends, Kondanya, his old friend was, gets it. He has a realization. He wakes up. He becomes enlightened. And the Buddha famously exclaims, "Kondanya knows! Kondanya knows!" And at that moment, you could say the full three jewels are complete. The Buddha is there. The Dharma as communication, as teaching, has happened. And another Buddha has appeared. Another awakened one has appeared. So we have Sangha. So this is sort of like the full moment. So then they carry on talking. And by the end of this epic meeting, we now have six fully enlightened beings. I don't know exactly what happens next, but for some reason they all go off on different journeys. And one of them, one of the other ascetics, his name is Ashvajit. Ashvajit means the horse tamer. I like that because I think it'd be really cool to be a horse tamer. So Ashvajit, that's where he features in this story. Ashvajit walks off, and Ashvajit meets another seeker, another traveller. You must remember, in India at this time, there would have been all sorts of seekers, practitioners, meditators, yogis wandering around the wilds. They were called shramanas. So Ashvajit, who's now an awakened one, he's now enlightened, he bumps into another shramana. And this shramana who he meets, another seeker, is called Shariputra. And Shariputra is struck with Ashvajit. He's struck with his presence. He's struck with the way he's being. So he talks to him. This is apparently what they used to say. They would approach each other. They wouldn't say, like, you know, what kind of music you into, what borough do you live in, whatever. He would sort of ask him his name, and he would say, "What is your Dharma? What is your Dharma? What is your code? What is your teaching? What path do you follow?" To this stranger. And Ashvajit says, "I follow the Buddha." And Shariputra hasn't heard of the Buddha. And Ashvajit and Shariputra ask him what he teaches. What does this man teach that you follow? And Ashvajit says something like this. And the words he say have echoed down history and around the world. It's this famous verse that Ashvajit utters to Shariputra. It's a verse which you can find all over the world, apparently. You can find it in rock caves in Afghanistan. You can find it in jungles in Indonesia. You can even find it on snowy peaks in Japan. It's the first teaching of Ashvajit to Shariputra. So he says to Ashvajit, "The Tathagata," that's another name for the Buddha, a very honorific name, "the Tathagata has taught the origin of things that arise from conditions. Their cessation too he has taught. This is the teaching of the great Shramana." So Shariputra hears this. So I just checking, because Shariputra heard this. And that was it. He totally got it. I can remember the first time someone told it to me, and they also waited, and I went... Can you say that again? not always that easy. It's important to remember with these things, like these first encounters that we read of with the Buddha. Shariputra himself was already a very advanced spiritual seeker. Yeah, he'd been practicing for a long, long time. Very, very advanced meditator, very advanced spiritual seeker. Had, as they would say, but little dust in his eyes. So it seems like the Buddha had sort of just advanced things just over the horizon to full enlightenment. So he was able to say something new, something precise, and Shariputra just got it. And also remembering the presence of an enlightened one when communicating with an enlightened being, the communication is direct and penetrating. Being with a Buddha was said to be like being with an elephant, in the sense of, I don't know if you've ever been with an elephant. I have been with an elephant, and it's quite a thing, actually. It's quite a thing. So a direct communication from an enlightened being. So something about that made Shariputra understand this truth. So this is what I want to look at in this talk is I'm going to give over the whole middle part of this talk to looking at what this utterance from the Buddha via Ashvajit to Shariputra could be about. Shariputra would go on to say, I'll say that in a second actually, but so this verse, this law, the Tathagata has taught the origin of things that precede, things that arise from conditions, their cessation too, he has shown. This is the teaching of the great Shramana. This has come to be known as the law of dependent arising, or the law, as it's known in Sanskrit, of Praticca Samutpada. It's the fundamental. If Buddhism has a fundamental philosophical position and a fundamental doctrine, if Buddhism has a credo, this is it: the law of dependent arising, dependent origination, conditioned arising, Praticca Samutpada. And this is what this is the teaching that is particular to the Buddhas. And Shariputra famously would go on to say that he who sees Praticca Samutpada sees the Dharma, and also he who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. So there's a famous sort of triangle in my mind between these three fundamental laws. So I want to look at this the Dharma. He who sees Praticca Samutpada sees the Dharma. He who sees the Dharma sees Praticca Samutpada, sees dependent arising. Okay, so this law of dependent arising, this fundamental philosophical position. So the first way we can look at what this maybe is getting at is on, this is the first way I started to look at it, was on the sort of material level. Things arise in dependence on conditions. They are made up of conditions. This is sort of the stuff, the wonder, the miracles of science that show us this. The way things, anything we can look at, anything we can see, all the objects of our world, we can analyze them and see how they're made of. See what they're made of, and you can sort of follow that journey on. I haven't got to the end of it. You know, you can start analysing objects almost at the end of it. Remember the first time I sort of had a bit of a wow moment with this kind of thinking was I was doing my... So I became a Buddhist quite early on, I was only 13 when I became a Buddhist, started going on to the Bristol Buddhist Centre. So I'd heard about this law, you know, didn't really, and I've been thinking about it since. But the first time I sort of had a little bit of a wow moment with this, I can remember I was doing my mock double GCSE double science paper, and there was this whole bit about the water cycle in my revision book, the water cycle, you know, how water kind of goes in all these different phases through the world. And for some reason, the revision paper was using an analogy from the Nile Valley Basin. I don't know why they did this, but, you know, they have sort of like, the textbooks have a funny kind of, angle on things. Anyway, this person. So it's all these images of the Nile Valley Basin and how water moves, you know, it comes down from the clouds, it waters the crops, it goes back into the cloud, comes into the river, goes into the ocean, sort of, back to, you know, it goes all the way around. And then it had this little sort of speech bubble and says, so just maybe the water you're drinking could be the very same water that the pharaohs used to drink. one of those sort of wacky school textbooks. But it was enough for me to get completely, like, I remember thinking, like, wow, you know, this water, you know, and everything, and that, you know, got me kind of thinking about how, you know, everything can sort of, what's the story of all these elements of our world? Where do they originate from? Where have they been? If everything's made of stuff that kind of moves around in these cycles. It got a bit further with this level when a couple of years later we were looking at A-level science, and was tackling cosmology in physics, and we were looking at space exploration, and we had to follow the story of a Voyager, which was this, I think it was this program to try and send satellites out into the universe, or telescope or something. They were, I can't remember exactly. I was better at history. Some clever guy, I think his name was Carl Sagan or something. Is that right? Yeah, that's right. He was, I don't know, some kind of genius, and was trying to find out the origins of the universe. And anyway, I remember another mock exam. Mock exams were better, because mock exams, you could relax a bit. You know, remember, mock exams were slightly better than the real things. And the mock exam question was a quote from Carl Sagan, which said, "We are such stuff as stars are made of. Explain and discuss." So, again, I had, in thinking about the question for the exam, I had a total, whoa, it's not just the water cycle. This thing goes on right back. He's saying that I go right back to the Big Bang. This must have been in the Big Bang. Right? I mean, I think that's the idea. I think the idea is that there was something at the Big Bang, and that we all, you know, everything came out of this Big Bang, and then it's all been kind of, you know, going on since then. So I'm sitting there with my mock exam thinking, like, God, I am a star. Yeah, I got a B. It's not bad, you don't laugh. I worked hard for that B. I had a Buddhist tutor. Maybe that's why I didn't get on quite as far, because we ended up talking about Buddhism too much. So this is like the first level, and if we're not careful, you sort of stay at this level. I remember talking to one of my main teachers about, the man who gave me my name, the man who called me Singamanas Sagramati, very, very, very good Buddhist teacher. I remember a conversation we were having early on, and he's he sort of said, go on, you know, what? Tell me what you know. What do you know about? Tell me what you know about Pratitya Samuppada. Tell me what you know about dependent arising. And I started talking about, you know, how everything did like this, and, you know, it's amazing, and if a butterfly flaps, and who knows what's going to happen, and da, da, da. And I kind of finished, and he was like, "Was that it? Come on, what, you know, what's? You haven't got very far, have you?" And I thought that was it. And he said, "Oh, no, no, Singamanis." Well, I wasn't Singamanis then, but he said, no, come on, think properly. Come on, lad. He was a Dundonian, so he still calls me lad, actually. But, what he pointed out was that this law goes, obviously, way, way further. It slightly reminded me of a famous episode with the Buddha and his attendant, when the Buddha had this friend who used sort of like sort of helper, a friend who was said to be his cousin, he wasn't enlightened, his cousin, and he went up to the Buddha one day and said, Lord, I got it. This law you teach, this dependent arising, is so simple, so clear, so easy to see. And the Buddha strongly rebukes him by saying, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Deep is this causal law. Profound is this causal law. That men do not understand this causal law is the cause of all this mass of sorrow and lamentation we call the world." Again, with the elephant presence, that would, you know, that really has quite an effect. I was reminded of that myself with my own rebuke. So why does it go further? Why does it go further? So the first thing, and this is what my friend teacher Sagramati said, is he said, "You have to look at your mind. You have to look at your mind, lad. Look at your mind." So this is the second level at which I want to try and approach this fundamental teaching, this fundamental doctrine of Buddhism, dependent arising based on the mind. So this starts to get a bit more weird now. So the first, just thinking of what, So of course, So what the Buddha also seemed to be pointing at is this law of dependent arising applies to the world and the mind. He seemed to be pointing out that the world depends on the mind. Just as the mind depends on the world. The constituents of all our experience are dependent on both the perceiver, the person experiencing the world, and the objects of our experience. And that this dependency is a kind of mutual dependency. Shariputra, I'm sort of reminded of it a little bit with the shrine. Shariputra described it as two sheaves of wheat or something leaning against each other, bringing each other up. So the first aspect of this for the mind is, of course, our perception, the world. Well, probably, it's the physiological level of our experience. We know that everything that we call the world comes through our senses and then is made up in the mind into a picture. We use, effectively, our imagination to reconstruct an image of the world. Charlie, last week, mentioned this famous Zen koan, "If a tree falls in the middle of a wood, and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound?" A famous Zen koan, which one is invited to reflect upon, to ask you, to what extent is your mind involved with the world? If there's no mind there, is there sound? Or what is there if there's not? And the same thing applies to, all the senses. You can sort of follow the reflection through with all the senses, testing the limits of how your perception works. I mean, our perception is our experience of the world is obviously it doesn't seem like we're doing it. It just seems like it's a given. Yeah. Sometimes it's called the original disposition of the mind. It's just the way things are given to us in our experience. So all this, all the light is coming in, the sounds, all the senses, all the information comes in, and our minds, obviously I know it's just, you know, we know it's vibrations, we know it's light bouncing off things through the retina, you know, our mind flips it round, all the science, yeah, all the brain stuff, and then we form that into a picture of the world. Yeah, it doesn't, you know, we can sort of see that. We just take it for granted. We just take it for granted that that's what it is. That's what it is. It's so taken for granted that we don't even seem to really notice our active side in that. It seems like we've just walked on to the set of something that's fixed, and there we've come into it, and voila. But you do start to really feel that this is funny when your perception goes weird, right? There are some times in life when your literal perception goes weird, and you start to get a sense of how much we are involved in this thing. So a classic example is, in my group earlier, I was reminded of this. We were talking a little bit about the effect of drugs on the mind, taking drugs. And I was reminded of, a really strong experience myself of taking some mushrooms in Amsterdam and spending the whole day lying on this decking at the top of this building in Amsterdam, looking at the decking. And, the drugs sort of did something crazy to my mind, opened the doors of perception. Everything went pretty funky, not without a little bit of, it's quite a strong dose of paranoia as well. But I can remember it being a very, there was a value in the experience insofar as, I got a very strong memory of spending the whole day looking at, there was decking on this roof, and I can remember I spent the whole day looking at the decking and looking at the shadows in all the little grooves on the decking. I must have been there for hours looking at this. My friend who I was staying with had a whole day at uni and came back, and I was still looking at the decking. And what I can remember is the planes from Schiphol Airport were going over the flight path, going over this house, and every time a plane would go by, I could feel the vibrations very, very sensitively. And the vibrations, I could see the vibrations making the wood shake. And the whole thing would give me like ecstatic, almost orgasmic kind of, oh my God! I mean, some people have these kind of trips and all kinds of stuff happens. I was just looking at decking. In fact, I looked a little bit like some of you guys out on the lawn earlier, looking at the leaves or looking at the stones, looking at little objects. But yeah, when the mind starts to open up and the doors of perception get shaken up, we start to realise that, you know. And after the trip, when I sobered up, and thank God I got back my thinking faculty, that was a relief. I did value, nevertheless, going, what was that about? That was weird. That was an altered state of consciousness, which took me somewhere else. Yeah. So, another easy example of this is, another example I was reminded of recently is, like, things happen like falling in love, yeah? Falling in love, natural thing that's happened, and suddenly your perception can change. Your perception of how things are can change. It's weird, isn't it? It's not, you fall in love, and you have the object, you have the beloved, the object of your love, But it doesn't just stop there. It's as if your mind is sent into a heightened state of awareness where all sorts can then be perceived differently. I mean, literally, things look more beautiful. Even your senses of space, your sense of time can go a bit funny. I was reminded of this because I watched that film Boyhood recently, and there's this lovely, it's a sort of wonderful film about a boy in real time, almost growing up. And there's his first, so he's reminded of his first love. And he's with this young woman, and they're staying at his oldest sister's pad in the city. So it's pretty cool. She's at university, they're staying there. He goes there, and they go to see a gig, and it's really cool. And then there's a scene where they're up really late at night just eating, they're in this diner just eating chips and cheese. And he's just sitting there, and they're totally in love with each other, and the whole world feels like a magical place. And he's just sitting, and it's Richard Linklater's dialogue, so it's very kind of slow and rich. And he sort of just goes, "What time is it?" And there's just this long pause, and she says, "I don't even know." And then there's another long pause, and they eat some more chips, and then he goes, "What are all these people doing here?" And she goes, "I don't even know." And it's just like, I remember what that's like, you know? The next scene, you see them walking across a car park, and the sun's coming up, and they're just like in another world, you know? They're just in another world, completely in love with each other. So yes, so some things happen to us which break the chink of our habitual perception, which if we pay attention to that, lead us to question what actually is going on. What is going on with this world and me and my experience of it? What's going on here? So another very important part of the mind, which comes in shaping our experience of the world, how the world arises in dependence on the mind, is our attitude and disposition to the world. It's really noticeable, isn't it? Sometimes two people can walk into the same place, and it's like they have a totally different experience. Totally different. It's like they've walked into a different world. Like two people walk into the same retreat, or it's quite noticeable, isn't it? In the group sometimes, I don't know what you're doing in my group, but in your group, but my group we do, you go around and hear how the retreat's going. We're all sort of doing the same thing, right? You know, we all eat the same food, we're living in the same building, and it's like 11 different retreats. 11 different retreats. Complete. It's like we're in different worlds sometimes. And we're even doing all the same kind of things. I mean, let alone being in London, you know, you walk past people and it's like, whoa, you're in a completely different world, you know. A large amount of this is just dependent on how we are, our disposition, our attitude. This sort of comes into the bracket of karma. Basically the Buddhist focus on this is that the disposition of our mind, the attitude of our mind, it arises in dependence on our behavior, on our actions. What we've been doing shapes the way our mind is, and that affects how we experience things. Well, one way the Buddha described this was like a potter. He described the meditator at one point, I think, as like a potter who sort of shapes his own mind, and then the way you've shaped your mind then determines how experience will sort of flow through you, what happens to you. The raw experience of life and the different shapes we fashion our mind in will lead to a different experience of things. Very, very, I mean, absolutely crucial law, crucial insight of the Buddha, that what the state of our mind affects what we make of what happens to us. And that is a cycle that can go well, can go better, and can definitely also get worse. There's no resting place in that cycle. This is sort of the law of karma. I can remember another example. I used to work for a very senior Buddhist teacher, very advanced practitioner, Subhuti, and we'd be in India, and we'd visit places, and we'd go around India visiting retreat centres. And Subhuti, incredible positivity, incredible sort of inspiration. He'd walk into a place, and you just feel better. You just feel better. A bit like a kind of I don't know what it's a bit like. It's just a force. He's like a force. Anyway, he'd walk into a place, and of course, everyone pleased to see him. He just makes you. He's just pleased to see you. You know, he got this beaming energy. So we'd go around these different places, and Subhuti would go into a place. He'd meet people. He'd go, "Oh, they seem to be doing very well. Things seem to be going very well there. Buddhists meditating well. Seem to be inspired. Good, good, good." And then we move on to the next centre, and the rest of his team would sort of be like, "No, Subhuti, like, when you're there, everyone's pleased to see you. Everyone's smiling. When you're not there, it's not always so easy." "I don't see it." Because, of course, he's, you know, with such a positive disposition, he walks into a different world every time he goes. He shapes the world around him. Yeah. So the world arises in dependence on his mind. And with such a positive mind, with such a skillful mind, such integration, such positivity, he experiences that kind of world. People become like that in his presence. Yeah. So this is really another important part of dependent arising, that our experience of the world arises very much in dependence on a mind. There's more truth in the original quote Carl Sagan was paraphrasing there is, of course, from Shakespeare, who said that we are such stuff as dreams are made of, all the activity of the mind. We are such stuff as dreams are made of the mind. So another area that important to bring out with dependent arising is also the dependent cessation. So just as things arise independent on conditions, they also, when those conditions cease, the things can cease. Really, really important aspect of the law, yeah? I think what's also really important to notice at this stage is I used to, for a long time, think of this law, dependent arising, as sort of like just cause and effect, sort of like this just this linear thing. But it's much more subtle, much more sophisticated than that. In the term praticca samuppada, praticca, dependent, sam, co, or together, or perfected, together, utpada, arising. But this co is very, very important as well. It's not just like this is there, then that happens. It's like saying things arise independent on each other together. And just as they arise in dependence on each other, when one ceases, the others can cease. Yeah. So there's a sort of little subtlety in there. So this is really, really. If I really understood this, I would be fully and perfectly enlightened. So I'm just going to sort of try and push a little bit further and pick up on some things that the Buddha particularly wanted us to look at. Because if everything's arising independent of conditions, what matters? What really matters? What do we look at? And it seems like the Buddha could have talked about anything. He could have talked about stars. He could have talked about anything, yeah? But he looked around and he thought, okay, I've seen something. I've seen a causal law, this deep law. Where does it matter most? And this is where he starts off his teaching with dukkha, the first of the noble truths. We heard a little bit about last week, the first of the noble truths, the truth of dukkha. Dukkha means something like dis-ease or dissatisfaction, pain, even suffering. The Buddha identified this as a truth. He said, this is an issue in the world, this dis-ease, this dukkha, this dissatisfaction. And he turned his mind, why does that arise? If we could find out why that arises, then that would really matter. That would really matter. That wouldn't just be academic. That wouldn't just be interesting. that would really matter. That could really change the world. So he looks very, very carefully at dukkha. And what he seems to come up with is the second noble truth, which is independence on what does dukkha arise. He seems to identify desire, deep desire, a desire that goes so deep it runs even through to beyond us, even through to the subconscious, even a deep desire in humans, of which our sort of conscious desire is just sort of like the bubbling surface. He called it tanha. The word is means something like, it's a poetic word which means something like thirst, but desire. He said independence on this deep desire, this craving, this urging, this hankering arises dukkha. And they arise together. He also went on to sort of map it out and saying independence on these arise all sorts of things. So for instance, you've got dukkha, you've got desire, you've got, he talked about time, perceptions themselves, the objects of perceptions themselves. He said all these things arise in dependence on each other. And this is where it starts to get really, really interesting. Because if they're dependent on each other, if they are relying on each other for existence, it means that they're not inherently of themselves fixed. They're not of themselves static and fixed and unchanging. Their existence depends on other things, which means that they're not completely fixed. They're not completely set in stone. If pain is dependent on desire, then pain doesn't exist completely and independently of itself. Its existence is contingent. It doesn't have inherent existence. Big idea. If any of these go, as it were, if any of these can cease, then the whole lot, then the ramifications are huge. Yeah, I mean that's right on the edge of my wonder, that notion. But I did have a little sort of glimpse of this earlier this year. I get particularly affected by time. Time bothers me quite a lot. I did study history, very good at history, got an A at history. Time's always bothered me quite a lot. Often in meditation, sometimes I sort of try and feel my own dukkha, try and feel my own dissatisfaction, and often it feels like just a sense of waiting, And sometimes when I probe it, I sort of say, Singhamanas, what are you waiting for? And I just don't know. It's often the sort of feeling tone of my own dukkha, is a sense of time, a sense of waiting, a sense of, yeah. So I was on I was reminded of this experience really recently because I was in London and really got completely intoxicated with a woman. Sort of fell in love with this woman. Didn't know them at all. Just one of those kind of passing, wow, you know. And she really invaded my mind for a few days. I got completely sort of infatuated, you know, that sort of crush, like kind of acute crush that can sometimes happen. Maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just London. Oh, God. Anyway, trying to meditate, total basket case, trying to meditate. just invaded by this object. But what I noticed, and this was useful, what I noticed was, God, it was painful, being really kind of gripped by this. Oh, and then I really noticed the heavy hand of time and the heavy hand of space as well, the two together. I noticed waiting, when am I going to see her again? When am I going to see her again? And also, when are we going to be together? You know, this really feeling of strong sense of, a strong sense of time, a strong sense of space. And the reason why I felt it very clearly was because earlier in the year, I'd been at my best. I'd been on retreat, solitary retreat, up in one of our retreat centres in the Spanish mountains. And I'd experienced there, on my own, meditating in the peace of the woods without the stimulus of the city. You know, the kind of peace that, you know, many of us are starting to taste here together. I started to really discover a sort of serenity, a kind of peaceful serenity where my own desire started to quell. I didn't really want for anything. I'd just sit. I had this little hut, and after having my after having a little coffee in the morning, felt very luxurious at the time, I'd just sit outside and sort of watch the sun just pop up over the mountain, just sitting there waiting, not really doing anything, been meditating for a while, my mind was in a good state, and just sort of like, yeah, I've never been so content, never been so serene. And what I noticed is, contrary to what I might have expected, being removed from the world, being far away, I didn't feel like that. I didn't feel far away. I didn't feel cut off. I didn't even feel lonely. I felt like the people in my life, the people in my mind, the strangers, loved ones, old friends, were very sort of accessible in my mind, very there. When I meditated, when I brought people to mind, anybody, I sort of felt, I could feel their presence. Sometimes even closer than when I'd be in Bethnal Green and just living down the road from them. There's something about my mind which was very lucid, very, very flexible. And likewise, my sense of time also really started to drop down. It was like my own past was suddenly not sort of strung out like a big rope ladder back into my childhood with sort of staged events, but it was much more fluid. It was like my own past wasn't fixed. Memories could come and I could just sort of, it's like they weren't sort of gone. It's like they were sort of, it was all present in a way. Even my own sense of my future didn't seem so like a daunting, like, oh, what am I going to do with my life? Oh, I'm Buddhist, I don't have any money, and no one's here. It didn't feel like that. It does feel like that sometimes. it was as if these things weren't so fixed, because my mind, the serene mind, it was as if my desire quelled, my sense of time, my sense of pain, my sense of space was also quelling. It was just a little glimpse, but God, it got me really, really, really interested. And it's said that when your mind starts to, when the original disposition of your mind, when the mind that we're given starts to sort of fade in this way, starts to cease, something else can happen. Your mind can move into a different way of being, a sort of open dimension of being. Yeah, you move into a different kind of experience. Yeah, and your mind starts to wake up. Okay, there's one final aspect of dependent arising which I also want to really pull out, and this is the principle of emergence that also is latent in dependent arising. So sometimes it can seem like you have this set of conditions and they'll lead to that set of conditions. And it sometimes can seem like it's sort of a closed system. But really, really important for this whole trajectory of dependent arising is this principle of emergence that runs right through. So for instance, you know, going right back to the water cycle I mentioned earlier. Again, I can remember... I was looking at a documentary, I remember they were exploring, I think they're exploring somewhere at the moment, aren't they? Like Pluto or somewhere, like taking photographs of it. Anyway, big deal is like the water situation, like is there water? And one of these science geniuses was explaining water. So apparently water is like really, really important. For life. And apparently that's because water is totally amazing. It can do all kinds of things. Apparently, there's nothing quite like it. And what is really interesting about water also is, apparently, if you were to take, like, a couple of hydrogen molecules, or whatever it is, atoms or whatever, and an oxygen one, you could never predict all the things that it does. You can never predict that. The things it can do from its constituent elements are totally remarkable, totally miraculous. Something else emerges from the constituent elements. Of course, the natural world is a fantastic example. These oak trees out here, you know, one just has to think about where they come from, the tiny acorn. The oak tree arises in dependence on the acorn and all the and the water cycle. And the water cycle. but of course, the oak tree that emerges from the acorn is like something else, right? It's not just like, you know, this leads to that. It's like something completely unknown seems to emerge. Very, very important principle for us sitting down to meditate. Often when it's the same principle that runs right through up to the Buddha himself. You know, like often we can think of what we're doing in Buddhist practice or meditating as a sort of a path of progress, a sort of path of development, a path of self-discovery or self-improvement or things like this. But the sort of principle of the Buddha is saying, no, there's something totally else. There's something totally else. Your potential to be a Buddha is not you on a good day. It's not just you on a good day. It's not just like a better version of you. It's not like the little acorn thinking, yeah, my potential. Say the little acorn's potential is to be an oak tree. You know, it's a bit like our idea of sitting down to meditate and being limited by our ideas of just being a bit better, me on a good day, is a bit like that little acorn thinking, when I reach my full potential, I'll be like this really big acorn, this huge, this great big acorn, really big, shiny acorn, like the best acorn in the whole of the field. All the other acorns will be really impressed by my presence, which will feel like an elephant when I roll around. You know, it's that is analogous to our sitting here and thinking my potential as a Buddha. When I become a Buddha, it'll be like just me on a good day with all my good bits, sort of really shining and a bit bigger, a bit more sexy, and a bit more kind of attractive. This principle of emergence is saying what can emerge in dependence on these conditions. What emerges is something, can be something else, something entirely new, something completely beyond our ken, something different, a new, you know, a different kind of species almost that can arise in dependence on us. And it seems like this principle of something new emerging, you could call it a transcendent principle of things transcending their conditions. We have a given set of conditions, and out of those conditions, something else, something new, can emerge. This principle seems to run right through life. It seems to be a principle that runs right through life, right from those little water molecules, right up to, the peak of life, which is the emergence of a Buddha, so this is, you know, sometimes I wonder, maybe this is perhaps what the Buddha is revering when he looks at the Dharma, and sees dependent arising. I wonder, possibly he might be revering that very principle which makes awakening possible in life, makes awakening possible in humans. So I just want to finish by just a few little reflections on what it might be like to see the Dharma or see dependent arising. Because one thing that is really, really important to remember is it's not, I mean, I've given this sort of Dharma talk, and it's very tempting to sort of get it as an abstraction. And it's not that. That we can be sure. Of course, the intellect is important. Of course, reason is vital. But really, seeing the Dharma is not an intellectual thing. It's not merely an intellectual thing. Really, seeing the Dharma transcends the intellect. Where reason goes so high, something else has to take over and continue to really see the vision. So I really want to make that clear, that understanding the Dharma on an intellectual level is vital, is important. It gives us something to reflect on, the teachings of the Buddha, to reflect on his understanding of the nature of reality. But a merely intellectual understanding will just stay abstract if we don't take it further. So yeah, so what does it feel a bit more like? I'm going to come back just to finish to this open dimension of being I mentioned earlier. When the mind starts to wake up and it moves into a more open dimension of being, what does that look like a bit? So the first thing I think it feels a bit like is things start to feel meaningful. Strange things can seem meaningful. You don't know what the meaning is exactly, but they sort of shimmer with a meaningfulness. It's like a state where things feel weirdly meaningful. And in that meaningfulness, things we experience seem to almost come alive, and it's almost like they start to, there's a communication. Things start to communicate to you. Like looking at a tree, it can suddenly sort of mean something. When your mind is more awake, when it's clearer, even just after some meditation, you know, you look at looking at some of these things around, they start to sort of be almost saying something. I was sort of really struck. I remember I was on this retreat last year. I was thinking about this today. There was this lady in my group, and she was a very, very sweet lady. She was very sweet natured. She hardly said anything in the group for most of the retreat. Hardly said anything. And I was sort of wondering, you know, if she was all right. And she seemed fine. She sort of, you know, we did our little reporting in. She said, you know, seemed like she's having a nice time and nice people, nice food, and sleeping all right. Da 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 da. And then on the last day, we were just sort of doing a little kind of how did the retreat go, a little kind of checkout thing. And it came around to her, and she said, yeah, it's been lovely. It's been a nice way to spend Christmas. You know, thanks very much. You know, that's fine. That's really, really good. And then it kind of moved on to the next person. And then she just sort of went, And I just went, yes. And she goes, well, there is something. And she said, she'd been coming to the evening rituals, just enjoying the atmosphere, enjoying the sounds and the candles and everything. And then she said one evening she'd gone out and she'd looked up at the stars as she came out of the shrine room. And she said she saw the stars. And she said she saw the stars for the second time in her life. She said, I saw the stars once when I was a girl, and I saw them last night again. And then she said she went to bed. It was so sweet the way she sort of told the story. She went to bed and she said, I was full of all this energy, could hardly sleep, tried to get to sleep, I couldn't sleep. So then I decided to get up, and I thought, I'll go for a walk. So she went for a walk in the dark, and she said, I found a place and I watched the sunrise. And she said she watched the sunrise, and as she watched the sunrise, all the stars started to disappear. And she said she felt like she'd never see them again. She felt like she was saying goodbye to the stars, and she felt incredibly sad. And then she said, so she turned back to face the retreat centre, but by this point the sun had risen, and suddenly she turned round, and it was all the stars had fallen from heaven and were just all along the floor, lighting her way back to the retreat centre. The sunlight was shining on the frost, which had gathered on the morning, and glistening. And she said it was as if all the stars, which she thought she'd never see again, suddenly were glistening on the floor And then she said, and she followed a star path all the way back to the retreat centre. I mean, I was pretty much in tears. And then she goes, yeah, that's me. And you know, it can be as simple as that. I think that, you know, an encounter with, when the mind starts to wake up and see things more clearly, it can be as simple as a story like that, where suddenly, you know, seemingly mundane things, seem that we seem to see all the time, can suddenly become like they're alive, like they're speaking to us, like they're meaningful. The final.